Eternity's longer, Sunbeam.
Welcome to episode 31 of the Minder podcast in association with Minder.org. I am your host, Paul Stenning. In this episode, we speak to camera grip for 53 episodes of Minder, Nick Pearson. Nick was behind the camera and at the technical helm for many classic episodes, from the very first to the last in series 5, and as you would expect, has some terrific insight into how it all came together. Some standout topics include working with the greats such as Roy Ward Baker, Robert Young and Christopher King, although with the latter he didn't start out quite so impressively. There are the tales about drinking with the crew, the bond between Dennis and George, the building of the first Winchester Club bar, and the trickiness of filming Dave the Barman. There is a lot about Euston Films itself, and some episodes we go into quite a lot, include The Bounty Hunter, Not a Bad Lad Dad, and Gunfight at the OK Laundrette. Nick kept saying OK Corral, but I did not wish to correct him. I'm sure he realised afterwards the retitling of the classic phrase for the Minder episode. When you look at all the work Nick has done over the years, it is spectacular. He has been involved with many major movies. So we are also treated to some wonderful stories about Tom Cruise, Brian De Palma, and Nick being sacked from Mission Impossible. He tells of Jack Nicholson ad-libbing in Batman, and how it was all captured perfectly on film. As Nick says, there is a lot more to acting than just delivering the lines. And then we lower the tone talking of the pleasures of the Benny Hill show. We start with an explanation of what a grip actually does. Nick sent this through to me ahead of our chat, which was useful to me, and I shall read this for anyone else who needs some guidance as to all of the responsibilities a camera grip has. So this is from American cinematographer, January 1984, and was written by Richard Patterson. Among the unsung heroes of film production is the grip. To the laity, the job title may be a source of puzzled amusement, especially when the uninitiated try to imagine the work of a dolly grip. Perhaps the only people on a crew who can fully understand the contribution of the grips, aside from the grips themselves, are the director of photography and the production manager or assistant director. They know how many shots each day would have been impossible without the specialised skills of the grips. They know the difference it makes to be able to rig a camera in an unusual place in 15 minutes rather than 30. They know that their ability to stay on schedule and within the budget is largely dependent upon the skill of the grips. Part of what a grip does is a very specialised form of construction. While he shares many skills with conventional construction workers, there are demands placed on him which would totally befuddle the average carpenter. Not only is he constantly having to wing it, but he has to build things with an eye towards taking them down right away. He needs to be an instinctive engineer who constructs only what it takes to get the job done and no more. And there is no end to the need for resourcefulness. Grips are absolute masters of the art of jerry-rigging. Far from being grunting hulks, grips are constantly involved in a form of communication which requires that they be aware of what the actors as well as the camera crew and electricians are doing and able to anticipate their needs. At its best, this communication may be virtually non-verbal, and a crew that is clicking is comparable to the Lakers in a fast break. He means the LA Lakers, this is obviously American basketball. As they set up a shot and follow through, each person's function is fluidly evolving in relation to the others. Obviously, anyone with a moderate amount of dexterity can set up a C-stand without bumping into lights or knocking over props, but to anticipate when it is needed, and to understand exactly why, requires that one be completely tuned into the entire production process. And dolly grips, of course, are something else again. If a film style is at all dependent upon a moving camera, the dolly grip must be like a musician who plays an instrument without being able to hear it. He has to work in perfect harmony with the camera operator and the actors, but what the camera operator can see in the viewfinder, he must feel in his arms and legs, or deduce from abstract markings on the floor. This is not to say that grips can't be down-to-earth types who appreciate beer and can hold up your car while you change the tyre. It is simply to suggest that we should never forget their real contribution to what appears on the screen. So now it is on with the show and an extensive chat with Nick Pearson, speaking from France, on this episode 31 of the Minder podcast in association with Minder.org. The Cat and Canary was the film.
Very first film I ever worked on. As a grip, I worked on films before as a stagehand.
Right.
I did films like The Stud, Joan Collins picture, very famous picture. But that used to be the way. Grips used to come in from being stagehands. And being a stagehand, you sort of learnt your trade. You learnt the construction side. And Cat and the Canary was, unfortunately, I never finished it. I had an accident. I fell off my garage roof at the weekend and busted my hand. So I only did the first about 3 weeks, I think. And so I had to come off. Cat and the Canary, that's a blast from the past.
Yeah, I probably have a few for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not going to read them all out, but I've certainly become aware of, there's a lot of good work that you've done, let's put it that way.
I'm just very lucky. And also, you make your own luck at times. In the film industry, you're only as good as your last job. And I think, like everything else, I without blowing my own trumpet, I did my job pretty well. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done the films that I did. I only got the sack once, let's put it that way, in 45 years.
I have to ask you what that was, if you can tell.
It was the first Mission Impossible. And
Tom Cruise himself?
No, not Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise, I did about four films with Tom Cruise, four different films with him. Eyes Wide Shut, Interview with a Vampire. But on Mission Impossible, Brian De Palma was the director, not a very nice man. And we did a crane shot, which involved about 30 moves on a crane in a big room. And De Palma, and it's all very, you know, you're swinging the crane following the actors. And De Palma kept giving the actors different, every time it broke down or didn't work, He kept giving the actors different instructions, but didn't tell us. So, you know, it's a tricky old number. If it's only a couple of moves, you can deal with those. But when you've got about 20 moves, you know, it's tricky. Anyway, it didn't work. And we got to one perfect take. And the camera, there was a guy walking around. He sits down next to somebody at a table in a canteen, and the camera sweeps down over his shoulder, and you see him put poison in the other guy's cup of coffee. And as we got in towards the cup, De Palma said cup. The focus puller thought he said cut and cut the camera. So that ruined that shot. So anyway, there was a big meeting about it. And De Palma said, right, get rid of the grips, because someone's always got to be to blame, you know. And they were going to fire one of the other grips. And I said, oh, well, hang on. I'm the key grip. I'm responsible for whatever goes on, for what my guys do. So they said, oh, I said, anyway, why has someone got to go? Oh, they said, to keep Brian happy. I said, well, make him laugh. I said, I'll go, but you've got to pay me up. And they paid me a month's money up front, plus my normal fees, what I was agreed. And I left on the Friday, and on the Monday, I was on another film on the next stage. So I got paid twice for the next month.
Mm.
So thank you, Mr. De Palma, for firing me. Now, Tom Cruise is a nice guy. I like Tom. He's very good with the crews. He understands what you're all doing, why you're doing it, and the fact you're trying to do it to make him look good, which is good.
So he's a very professional in that sense.
Yes. Funnily enough, since I've retired, I've heard a couple of reports that he sort of went off at a bit of a tangent and started being a bit angry, shall I say. And I think it was out during the COVID thing. And I think some of the certain members of the crew weren't paying attention to what they're supposed to be. They weren't following the safety rules. I mean, it was very rigid, I believe, the safety rules, about wearing masks and everything else and whatever. And apparently he got very angry, but I never saw that side of him. As I say, three, I'm trying to think of the other film. I did at least three films with him. And he was gentleman personified. On one occasion, on Interview with a Vampire, we did a big crane shot, and I was moving the crane, and he suddenly turned around and, without looking, just ran to go offset and ran headfirst into the crane. And I thought, oh no, I'm fired, you know. And he suddenly stopped and he said in a very loud voice, "I'm very sorry, boys. That's my fault, not yours. And I want everyone to know that." Well, you can't ask for more than that, Paul, can you?
Oh, that's interesting. Very
Yeah. Yeah,
just
nice
shows
guy.
you. It shows you when you speak to people who actually work with these people who gain a reputation of whatever description, that you will see different sides to them, good, bad, or indifferent. And
Of course, of
it's nice
course.
to know this type of thing.
I was very, very lucky. He was very good. I did several films with Michael Caine. Wonderful technician, knew what everybody was doing and why and how. Can I help? Jack Nicholas on Batman. Absolutely stunning. Really aware of what everybody did and why, which that helps, you know. I came across one or two who weren't so endear, crew aware,
Yes.
and they were just there to for themselves. But it was quite rare when you're on a film for or a TV series. You can be there for months. You become a team, like a bit of a family, really. Yeah, it works.
You're the first person who I've spoken to who actually counts as part of the Minder crew.
Oh,
And
really?
I think you were, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're kind of the dream team part of the crew in the sense that you were there for many, many episodes and it's
Yeah, I
you
did
were
the first
viewed.
four series, which was 52 episodes.
Yeah. You were viewed as when people came in, because I've spoken to a lot of people who did one or two episodes,
Yeah.
maybe five, and when they came in, they virtually all said that they were very aware that it was the crew, and the crew very much got on with Dennis, and there was kind
Oh,
of
yeah.
a camaraderie that they were either welcomed into, or sometimes some of them felt like it was too cliquey, as it were. Not often,
It
but.
was we had a great social life as well outside on Minder. We just down the road from where our first base was in Blyth Road, there was a wine bar called Frogs, PHROGGS, and it became like the unit bar. So overnight, everyone we would go in there and have a glass of wine or half a pint, before we went home. So it became a very big social occasion. And every fortnight, when as an episode finished, we'd have more than one glass of wine and more than half a beer, you know. We'd have a little whip round amongst everybody. And I'd go around and collect, I don't know what it was now, pound, 2 pound off of everybody, put it in the jar, you know. And George Cole, of course, didn't drink. But every week, every fortnight, George will give me 10 pounds. You know, I'll put that in the, although he didn't come in the wine bar. He'd say, here, Nick, put that in with the book, buy the boys a drink. And, you know, it was lovely. Dennis, of course, was a great lover of pubs. I'll say no more.
Don't worry, I've been told that before.
We used to say to the assistant directors, why do you call him early when we're in a pub and he's not needed for a couple of hours? You know what's going to happen? He's going to be at the bar. Bless him. But he was great fun. He was a good character, and him and George between them, they were wonderful. The chemistry of the two actors was absolutely stood out.
So, I mean, I'm really interested as to how you see the action when you're, from my understanding, again, it's only from what you sent to me that I began to understand what you would be doing. And from my understanding, you can be building things, taking them down. You have to anticipate people's needs, be it behind the camera or in front of the camera. So I guess that you're kind of watching everything at the same time.
I mean, to start off, Paul, is I would read a script. You're always given a script before for each episode. I mean, I'm talking now about TV and we're talking about Minder. I would read the script. The cameraman, we had two cameramen. When I did it, Roy Poynter and Dusty Miller. One would shoot that episode, and while he was shooting that episode, the other guy would recce the next episode. So, for argument's sake, if Roy was doing a recce, he'd come back to the base where we were shooting, and he'd say to me and the other guys, hey, look, we've got certain situations here, we're going to need, you better go and have a look at them. And you work out beforehand, most of it you work out before you start shooting. But yes, of course, during the course of the shoot, things can change. And the director, you'll get a director will suddenly go, oh, I want to do so and so. And you'll go, we haven't got the equipment to do that, but we can do so and so, so and so. You know, with what we always carry a standard amount of equipment. It was the bog standard, whatever. Cameras and grip equipment and lighting equipment and construction equipment. But if a director beforehand, when he did a recce for his episode, if he wanted something different, obviously he would tell the producer. And then the producer would work out whether or not he could afford it. And he would come to us and say, you're going to need so and so, so and so. But very often he would say, you'd get a director who would come in and he'd suddenly change his mind on the day. That was a tricky one, and you'd have to sort of try, you tried your best to give him what he wanted. But if you didn't have the equipment, it's like everything else, you'd have to make do and try and, you'd wing it, as we say.
Oi, clock this, sweetheart. Never mind page three, you're on page one. On the front, the lonely woman who waits in hope.
Not very nice of me, is it?
Well, you're distraught, aren't you? And Terry's going to be well distraught too when he reads a bit about you two getting married.
Yeah, I've only ever spoke to him twice.
All the women and kids are asleep, eh, Terry? Don't you trust the other two with a gun?
Not if you're awake. Man, it was gonna be so easy, eh? What the hell you had to mess it up for? Wasn't your money?
No, it wasn't yours either.
So what? He rips it off from the people, I rip it off from him. Listen.
They put 50p in a machine, and they sit there and watch their pillowcases go round and round. They got a choice. You come storming in with a shotgun, nobody's got a choice at all.
They really got to you, eh? But you know what they really did? They just kidded you into going straight.
Wrong. They bored me into it. Got fed up with people saying 3 years, Wormwood Scrubs. Someone loses a dog, I'm in the local nick for 2 days. So now, I just throw a few drunks out of clubs, ask people to repay their gambling debts, rent a muscle. Easy hours, but not a lot of what you might call job satisfaction.
You let them beat you, man.
And what are you going to be? Al Capone?
Yeah. Bigger. Bigger.
You got more chance of winning a pool, son. It's got to be for me, innit? Hello?
We had some lovely guys on Mindup. Tommy Clegg and people like him who've been around the business and worked on TV shows for years.
The Sweeney Tom Clegg.
Yeah. Well, you've got to think really in reality, the two cameramen, Roy and Dusty, both did the Sweeney. Most of the directors who did Minder had worked on the Sweeney. They're all Houston Films people.
Yeah.
I never did it because I wasn't in that at the time. I met Roy Poynter. How I got onto Minder, right? I suddenly had a brainstorm, decided I wanted to be regularly employed. And I heard that Thames Television were advertising for a full-time grip. So I applied and got the job. I was there 2 weeks and I didn't want to be employed. I realised the implications and the limits. And I got put on with Roy onto the film inserts for the Benny Hill show,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, was great fun. Needless to say,
yeah,
it was a pleasure to go to work every morning. And I did this for 3 weeks with Roy. And I said to him, look, I'm leaving Thames. I'm going back freelance. So he said, OK. And then he started calling me because he was freelance, Roy, and he was doing commercials and things, and he would call me. And he suddenly rang me up then after a couple of months and said, oh, look, I've got this TV series called Minder. Would you like to do it? And so that's how I got onto Minder. That's most of the crew, Johnny Maskell, who was the operator, wonderful, wonderful operator, Johnny Maskell. A lot of the directors, Saker, two cameramen, had all worked for Houston Films.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Minder base when we first started was Blythe Road, was only round the corner from Collett Court, where Houston Films used to be based. And there was a reason, I can't remember now. I mean, we're now talking 45 years ago, of course.
Yeah.
And I ain't getting any younger, nor is the memory. But there was a reason that we didn't have Collett Court as a base, and I don't know what it was. And so they found the old National Savings building in Blythe Road. So we used that as the unit base. And also they built the first Winchester Club there as a set. And Arthur's car lot was just along the road, so it was quite handy, you know. And much to our delight, we found there was a wine bar just over the road. So it was good. But it was just a continuation of Houston Films with a few different people like myself brought in.
Did you help helped to construct the original Winchester then, if you were there at
Well, no, not me. No, you had the construction crew with that.
Right.
Now, as a grip, see, it's changed a bit today. They call them key grips now. In the old days, we were just called camera grip. And on the crew, there would be a carpenter, a rigger, a stagehand, and a painter who all worked in conjunction with the grip. So if we needed anything built for the camera, rostrums or tracks, the boys would do it for me on my behalf. You know, and I'd say to them, look, this is what we need, there. And you then had a separate construction crew that did all the rest of the things and built the sets, the standing sets, or if they'd go into a location and it wasn't quite what they wanted, the construction crew would go in there pre-shooting, of course, and make any alterations, put things in, and, you know. So you had two different sets of construction. You had the construction crew proper, who were a full, absolutely full crew, did everything. And you had a designer and all the set dressers and people and prop men. But then on the set, you had this very small construction crew who would work to the instructions of the director.
Right. So when you were kind of, how far away would you be from the actual, say, the bar itself? When you're filming the bar, how far away would it be?
That depends on the shots. That depends on the shots. You've either got close up or far away.
Yeah.
You know, and that can be adjusted with lens. What I did on after the first series, the bar was fixed in the Winchester Club. Well, when they changed the location and they built it somewhere else, because the base moved up to Acton. And I asked the designer, I said, could you do me a favour? Put the bar on casters so we can move it in and out and they can get in close with the camera. And it worked quite well. And it depends. It's how long is a piece of string, but you've also got these wonderful things called zoom lenses.
Yeah.
So really, how close you are, yeah, I think sometimes you get a different look with different lenses, of course. A long lens and a wide angle lens will give you a difference, a slightly different appearance. But I think they tend to, on Minder anyway, they tended not to try and put the camera up people's noses, you know, give them a bit of room to work in. And that's obviously a decision the operator, the cameraman, or the operator, the you know, director of photography, the cameraman, and the director have to make between, they have to make that decision. That was never a decision of mine. All I do is position the camera where they wanted it, or we run it on rails or on tracks. If we were moving, if the camera had to move. And when we moved, if the actors walked across the set, they'd say, right, we want to go with him. So I'd operate a dolly. The operator would be sitting on the dolly. He'd obviously keep the frame correct. And I'd adjust the speed to go with the actor. You know, we'd agree beforehand, obviously, between the director and the operator, they'd agree what they wanted. And the rule of thumb was, if they moved, we moved. If they stopped, we stopped. And I can explain in a little way. After Minder, I got a call from a rental company. Would I go to Germany with them for a day to look at a new dolly that was coming out? And it was at an exhibition. Would I go with them and tell them what I thought about it? So we go there. No, it was in Paris. Sorry, it was in Paris because we went on the first time I'd ever been on the Eurostar. And this dolly had a bit of like very early computer control. So the jib that moves up and down, all beforehand, all jibs were operated on air pressure, on a handle which you controlled to move it up and down. So if the actor stood up, you could rise the camera up with them. If they sat down, you could drop down with them. Well, this one had preset modes by this very small computer. And this German guy said to me, "You set five different modes." I said, "Yes." "So what happens?" I said, "When the actor does what all actors do, he's supposed to stand up and he doesn't quite, and he changes his mind and sort of drops back down again and then goes." I said, "I've already pressed a button here on these presets and the camera's gone, it's up." He said, very German, he said, "This they must not do." So I said, "Right, I'll take your dolly on my next film as long as you come with me and tell the director
Yeah.
that." So it's a matter of feeling. It was like on the crane, you see, when we're operating, I'm operating the crane, camera crane. You get to know your actors. And it takes a couple of days when you go on a film and you're the director or actors you don't know, because they all have their own ways of walking and moving. Glyn Edwards, who was the barman, Dave the barman, the first series of Minder, we never saw him. He never came round the bar. So the second series, there was a couple of scenes where he came round the bar, and I didn't realise he had a very strange sort of rolling gait. He had something wrong with one of his legs, and he didn't. It looked like he was going to move, but he didn't. He threw you a wobbly, really. It took a couple of goes to get used to him, and we were all laughing and saying, "Blimey." They were all saying to me, "Oh, come," the operator, saying, "Oh, come on, Nick, get it right." But you get to know actors, you see how they react. I remember Jack Nicholson on Batman. We had a sequence where he was totally ad-libbing, and I missed him twice. And he said, "Is there a problem, guys?" And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, Jack, you're ad-libbing so differently every time. We never know which way you're going to go, or I don't." And I said, I've missed it." So he said, "Right." So he said to Mike, the operator, "Where are you cutting?" Mike said, "Just below your waist." So he said to me, now this is how good he was. He said to me, "Okay, Nick, watch my right leg. When I go, I'll wiggle my foot." You couldn't ask for any more than that, could you?
So it's literally prompting you to what to do whilst he's trying to maintain some.
And all the time he's acting. George Cole had a classic sign he used to say very often, "I know. Walk fast, look like I'm running. Pretend you're not all there, and don't trip over all you lot, and act at the same time." It was very true. Sometimes you ask actors to do a lot more. There's a lot more to it than just delivering the lines, you know? And this is why, in the early days, I found a lot of British actors came out of theatre. So they weren't used to the technicalities of filming. Now, American actors were superb because that was their thing was film. They were more into film than theatre. And it's very different. And it showed up, of course, it changed. British actors became more and more involved in film and television, of course. And so that changed. But in the early days, in the say the early 70s, you had a lot of actors who would come on stage, or should I say on set, and be totally unaware of all what's going on around them, and would get quite upset. "You're standing in my eye line. I'm not standing in your eye line. I'm standing here because I'm operating the dolly. I have to be here." Oh, and some of them, get a bit cranky about it, but I think You know, if you had a good director, he would say to him, come on, you know, blah, blah, blah. You have to live with the technicalities, and filming is a technical job.
So would you say that the people who understand that actually end up with a better scene because of it?
Difficult one to say. Possibly. I mean, if we're talking about being on television or on film, possibly. But actors, for the very reason that they're actors, are very quick to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I've found over the years they're very quick to learn. They know they've got to get it right. And eventually it doesn't take them long to realise that we were there, everybody, no matter who you were, what department, makeup, wardrobe, electricians, whatever, you're there to help them, to make them look good. So most of them, yeah, you know, most of them then took it in their stride and worked with it and realised what everybody was doing, which is a great, which makes their job easier, I'm sure.
Yeah. Would you say that Minder got, did it become easier from the second series onwards, from everybody working together perspective?
Oh, yeah, when we did the first, when we started Minder, we shot, the first episode we shot didn't go out first.
Yeah.
It went out fourth. But it was to break the crew in and get everyone to get to know each other, you know, because there were quite a few people on there. I mean, I'd never worked with George or Dennis. I'd worked with Roy and the operator, who the first one was Brian Alvin, very good film operator. And he did the first series because John Maskell, who they wanted, wasn't available. And so it takes a while for you all to get to know each other, you know. So they, very clever, they did this episode that, funny enough, Derek Jacobi was in it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, a wonderful Shakespearean actor playing a crook.
Yeah.
And he was very good.
That was about timeshare in Mallorca or something.
Yeah. I remember Bounty Hunter. It was called a Bounty Hunter.
Yeah. Ricky Howard as well was there.
Yeah. And so Minder, Houston, I thought was quite a clever move. Shot that first to get everyone up to scratch, you know.
Mr. Fenton?
I'm in the house opposite, keeping an eye on
your front door, so you better stay put.
Now, what I want you to...
Hey, Dad, look, you're trespassing.
No, I'm not. I'm exercising my citizen's right of arrest.
What do you mean?
Sunworthy. Can only mean one thing, can't it?
Look, I don't know what you want.
I want £6,000 that belongs to a friend of mine, Mrs. Josephine Williams, who put it down as a deposit on one of your villas that never got built.
Are you trying to threaten me?
I'm not sure yet. We'll see how it goes. I've just been talking to Hurst.
Oh, no doubt. He told you I was the villain and he was the harmless dupe.
No.
Yeah, well, let me tell you something. He was no help at all. He was supposed to be partners. He was supposed to be the business expert. All he knew about was selling, now not to upset the natives.
It's not very easy to admit you failed.
Oh, I hope you're not going to make me cry. I get upset very easily.
I don't want to upset anybody.
You should have thought of that before you conned Mrs. Williams and the rest of them out of their money.
I didn't con anybody.
If you didn't con Mrs. Williams, how come she lost £6,000?
I've done my best to pay everybody back.
If anybody was conned, I was.
Oh.
All right, I was a bad businessman.
I was undercapitalised. I got taken by the bloke who owned the land in Mallorca. In the end, I found I was paying way over the top for it. It's been a bloody nightmare. I wish I'd never got myself into it.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
There's nothing I can do about it. I'm bust. Broke.
So she's just got to write off £6,000?
I wish I'd only lost £6,000. Everything's gone, the lot. They didn't take my car away. I had a beautiful Jag.
Wish I'd never heard of Mallorca. Look, I'm doing my best to get straight. And if I do, I promise.
Oh, don't make promises you can't keep. Oi, what are you living on?
Social Security.
You mean a poor old taxpayer has to keep the likes of you?
I've paid my share over the years.
Myself, I see nothing against using a bit of pressure.
Fair. Would have done no good at all.
Well, if you say so. Are they saying anything about my membership, Harold?
Oh, I'll leave it a bit, Arthur. Come as my guest a few times. Show your face, I'll introduce you around, and then we'll put out a few feelers.
It's not a night what I'm after. I just want to join the club, that's all.
So you'll tell Joel, right?
Me? That's your department. I just tell her good news.
See what I mean about the narrow lapels?
Yeah, more discreet. She's working till 9 tonight, and I'm going to Montclair with Harold.
Well, we...
What do you think about the whistle, Terry?
What does he know?
Yeah, what do I know? I'm still into wide lapels.
And then we shot... The only time we went over 10 days, we did, the next was Gunfight at the OK Corral, which we had 3 weeks to shoot because it was going to be the opening night. It was going to be the opening night episode.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I don't think it was very good. In hindsight, I thought it was a bit naff.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's a bit too heavy on the focus in the laundrette too much, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that towards the end of my career, I moved over to doing lots of crane work, and I got a reputation as being a crane grip.
Yeah.
And I used to get called in on jobs because digital was starting to come in and all these remote systems that could do it all themselves on computer. So they'd call me in to do the shot as per normal, and the computer would record what the crane had done. And then I'd go and sit down and read the newspaper for the rest of the day, and the computer would take over, and the new crane they brought in would be totally computer controlled. It was robot, really.
Mm.
But the problem is, when you do that, the actor has to do the same thing every time. He's got no leeway. He can't suddenly think, "Oh, I'll lean a little bit the other way." So it's got its drawbacks, technology, but it is phenomenal what I see today. I wouldn't get employed today that way, only because of my lack of knowledge, because it's fallen. I try and keep up, and I talk to the guy. I'm going to, in 2 weeks' time, coming over to the UK, it's the Grips Veterans Lunch. Every year, the union or the branch, the Grips branch, throw a lunch for all us oldies, which is quite nice.
Yeah.
Only when we started the branch 40 years ago, and I was one of the founder members, we started a benevolent fund by having a raffle. Every time we had a meeting, we'd have a pound in the bag raffle, and someone would bring a bottle of scotch or a bottle of wine, and we'd raffle it, and we'd put that money into if anyone was sick or something like that. It has grown enormously now, and it's in the last 5 years, they've given out £100,000 to various causes. People been ill, fallen on bad times and whatever. And every Christmas now, all us oldies, we get a hamper from Fortnum & Masons. I don't get a hamper because of the customs problems. So they send me an Amazon voucher. But they also give us this, throw this big lunch for us, which is good. And we go there, and it's good in a way because you've got the young guys go and us oldies, and we learn quite a bit off of them. And in their way, they learn off of us as well.
Yeah.
And I was one of the innovators. We started an apprentice scheme for Grips. Dennis Fraser and myself. and the branch, the Brits branch, we started this training scheme. We got government money. We got some money backing. And what we did, we got these young lads who wanted to be grips. We put them into the rental houses so they could learn all the equipment first, and then they'd be there for about a year. Then they'd come out as an assistant, you know, a trainee.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worked very well. There's now, when we started the branch, there were 30 members. There's now 250. And at the last count, at the moment, there are 110 trainees. So wow. It's grown beyond all imagination, you know.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
I've just got two more questions for you, Nick, if that's all right.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned quite early on about different directors. I was just wondering if, I know you mentioned Tom Clegg, but did... Because obviously there were different directors and some did more episodes than others. Were there any directors in particular that you really enjoyed working with or thought were very good?
Robert Young was good. Good fun, Robert. Terry Green, wonderful Terry Green. And I worked with Terry Green outside of Minder as well. Robert Young, I worked outside of Minder on other films. Peter Sasdy, who did Gunfight in the OK Corral, he was never my favourite. He was a bit strange.
He's Hungarian, wasn't he? Or he's
sorry?
He's Hungarian.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the other. There is another one. I'm trying to think. My brain's going. Who was married to a choreographer? Fans, people, and we always laughed. He was he drove a Ford, one of these great big Ford Capris with a, you know, great big engine in it, very flash, and spent most of his time while we were filming chatting up the girls who were walking past, which was always quite amusing. But because he wasn't very successful at it, there you go. No, there were some great directors. And most of the mind directors on Minder, if I'd thought of this, I'd have written out a list beforehand to remind myself. Obviously, we're most quite experienced. The only one who came on who wasn't was a guy called Chris King.
Yeah.
And Chris King, the first time he came on, he stood there. We were doing a night shoot in Slough, which is not the nicest place to do a night shoot. And we're standing there, and he's got his book and his script, and he said to Johnny Maskell, "What are we going to do now?" John and I looked at each other and thought, this is going to be interesting. But he did later on, he turned out to be a very competent director, but he'd never done that sort of television before. And funnily enough, John and I then went to do a TV thing he did down in Cornwall called Heather Ann. And it was very good. He was good, Chris King.
Help yourself.
Oh, so.
Well, 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 we have a movie expert with us today. The winning answer came through in 15 seconds, would you believe? And here is the lucky fella. Hello, who's this?
Hello?
Your name, sir?
Albert. Albert Stubbs.
All right, Albert. What film ended with the line, "Mother of Mercy, is this the end of Rico?"
Little Caesar, starring Edward G. Robinson, made in 1931. Directed by Mervyn LeRoy.
Fantastic. You must be in the film business, Albert.
No, nothing like that. Last 4 years I've been in the nick. Just got out today.
That's you.
Well, well, well. It's your lucky day and no mistake. Tell me where you live, Albert, and we can send you on the T-shirt and the car sticker.
Flat 4, 14 Langley. Langford Road, Essex.
You are out of your bleeding tree.
No, no, I always was good on films.
All right, then, come on. What's your bloody lark?
What do you mean?
I know. It's one of Arthur's little jokes, isn't it? I'm on candy camera.
No, 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 it's nothing like that. I just didn't think, that's all. Sorry, old son, honest. It's just like being out and all. I can't handle it yet, not for a bit. You know what I mean? What you doing?
Well, thanks to your competitive spirit, we've got to get out of here.
Oh, yeah, reckon.
This is a recording.
Look, there must be thousands of Albert Stubbses around.
Oh, yeah. They've all done 4 years. They all came out today, and they're all nutters. And I'm looking after every sodding one of them.
Hello?
Yeah, hello. Is Arthur there, please?
Who?
Daly, Arthur Daly.
I'm afraid he's out at the moment.
Oh, well, if he comes in, could you ask him to phone Terry, please? It's urgent.
Terry?
Yeah, no. Ta-da.
Goodbye.
All that cauliflower cheese has scrambled your brain.
So, we're not moving then?
No.
I think we should.
And where should we go, Maestro? Fort Knox. Wait. Don't you want to see whether you made the news?
Don't let go.
Yes. Yes, thank you. We heard it too. So did everyone else. Thanks for calling. The what? The reward? $100 just for listening to the radio. Jack, you look like desperate Dan Wavernia. Go and serve. Hello. Yes, yes, we heard it as well, thanks. Yeah, well... No, don't bother, we'll call you. Up yours too, darling. Oh, no, God. It's all right, Jack. I'll serve the lady. I've got a job for you.
But he started out very young, and they did. They brought in a few very young directors, I think, trying to look it for new blood, you know?
Mm.
And... But most of the directors at Euston and like the Sweeney and the professionals, even the professional, I mean, lots of them did all three different series. So they were well-established TV directors.
Yeah.
You didn't, of course, the most famous one, really, the next film man was Roy Ward Baker. Now, this is the man that directed A Night to Remember, the Titanic film.
Yeah.
He went to Hollywood and directed a Marilyn Monroe film. And he was excellent. He really knew his business. But very old-fashioned filmmaking with Roy. And even in those days, we thought it was slightly old-fashioned. But it was very successful. So, you know, you can't knock it.
What do you mean by old-fashioned in terms of filming? How would that work out?
When I see television today, they all speak over each other. There's background music playing while people are speaking. You can't hear what they're saying. I know my hearing's not as good as it was. But in the old days, if you go back to the old black and white films, actor A spoke, he stopped, actor B spoke. They never crossed their dialogues.
Yeah.
And it was very clipped. And Roy Ward Baker, he filmed like that, very in a slightly old-fashioned way. I watch television today, and I do despair sometimes. I say to my wife, they've got this music playing loudly over people talking.
Mm.
And people talk, you get two or three people in a scene, they all talk over each other. Well, with the likes of Roy Ward Baker in the old days, the old black and, what I call the old black and white directors, if there were three people in the scene, he spoke, she spoke. and there was a gap in between, an editing gap. I mean, they could close the gap up by editing, of course, but it was slightly different. That's just one of those little things I remembered.
Well, I think his episodes are actually some of the best, so there's obviously something in that.
Yeah, he was very good. He did quite a few after. I think I did two or three with him, and it was funny. When it would have been series two, and they approached John Maskell to be the operator, and Roy Ward Baker came, and he said, "I want Cease Cooney." Now, Cease Cooney was a very old-time operator. Lovely, lovely man. And Cease Cooney used to get taken out to Hollywood to do the Gene Kelly movies. And they'd pay an American operator to sit indoors. That's how good he was.
Mm.
So Roy wanted Cease Cooney, and Cease Cooney did, I think, two episodes. I learned so much off of Cease Cooney in those couple of episodes of filmmaking. He was very clever. And it was a different way of filming. And I don't mean that in a detrimental way. It's just that it changed years later, filming, you know, the way people film changed, as everything else does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Can I just ask you one more question, Nick, on Minder? Just on, did any episodes in particular stand out to you in terms of filming them or just watching what was happening?
I've got so many memories. You only sort of remember the ones I sort of remember I thought weren't the best. It's like the one where the piano went in the swimming pool.
Ah, yeah, Dreamhouse.
Yeah, I wasn't too impressed with that. Or, unfortunately, Gunfight.
Yeah.
Some people, it's different things now. There was a one which a lot of people said they didn't like was the one with the little boy.
Is it? Oh, yeah. Dad? Not a bad lad, Dad.
Not a bad lad, Dad. Yeah, that's the one. And I thought it was very good. The boy was good. He acted well. He did what he was, you know, asked of.
Absolutely.
And it seemed to work. But a lot of people I read on, when you read on the Minder sites, like on Facebook or whatever, I look at the Minder sites, people are often quite derogatory about it. But it's, you know, it's what it is, isn't it?
You know,
we've all got an opinion, Paul.
Absolutely. I really like that one. But I do agree with you on the very first episode was not the best and never has really sort of worked.
Yeah, I thought it was a shame. And in a way, because you see, it wasn't until we did a second series that they suddenly realised it was a comedy.
Yeah.
It won a comedy award.
Mm.
Because when the first episode, when we did Bounty Hunter, George Cole drove a Austin Maxi, and he didn't have the hat on.
You know, I'd have to relook at that. I can't picture that.
Yeah, and also, he put the hat on quite quickly.
Yeah.
He brought it in with him, and they went, "Oh yes, that's the keeper."
Yeah,
George Cole wasn't first choice.
No, we've mentioned this a few times. It was either Denham Elliott or Lee Montague from
Lee Montague.
Yeah.
Now, if it had been Lee Montague, it would have been a very different, it would have been no comedy.
Yeah.
It was George. And in hindsight, when Dennis finally left, I think, I've never spoken to him about it. But I think he felt that it had become the George Cole show.
Mm-hmm.
That's my feeling. And that Dennis sort of thought he'd done, his character was taking second place because originally the vehicle was for the Minder.
Yeah.
Dennis.
Because he's first on the credits, isn't he, for that reason?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it was made for Dennis. Dennis was already cast. It was Dennis, apparently, who suggested, who was the first person you
Denham
mentioned?
Elliot.
Denham Elliot. But once again, Denham Elliot, wonderful actor, but it wouldn't have been funny.
You look back at it now and you just realize the casting was immaculate for what it became.
George often, story, George often used to say to us, when we'd say, "Oh, George, can you run a bit slower or run a bit faster or do this when you come?" He used to say, "Oi, I'm the only second choice, you Which is
Wow,
lovely.
that's fabulous.
Okay, Paul,
All
look
right.
forward to hearing from you.
Cheers, Nick.
Take care. All the
Bye for
best,
now.
buddy.
Very warm thanks to Nick for making the time to speak with me, and also a big thank you to listener Mark Witherspoon. It was Mark who came to me and suggested Nick might come on the show, and of course I couldn't wait to speak to him. Thanks to both for making it happen. I also asked Nick whether he had any photos from his time on the Minder set, and he sent me some fantastic material. These are going to be online with this episode on the Minder Podcast website, so go and take a look. The ending to this show is being recorded on the 8th of May. 2 years after Dennis Waterman's passing. If you haven't already, please do go back and check out the tribute shows. I shall provide the links. It always amazes me that Dennis was 23 years younger than George Cole. That's amazing in itself when you look at the chemistry between them and the fact that George Cole seemed a lot younger. But Dennis was 23 years younger and yet lived 16 years less. That's an incredible statistic to me, and such a shame. However, I think this show is another nice tribute to the one and only Terry McCann, and hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening, and thanks for all the memories, Dennis. Rest in peace. To honour him once more, we will end the show with one of my favourite ever Terry McCann clips.
You do understand that this is not an investigation. I'm trying to elicit information. The thing is, we've lost track of you, Mr. McCann.
Really?
How would you describe your occupation?
Well, it's tricky, really, isn't it? I mean, it's just odds and ends, you know.
Self-employed?
Well, I get by.
Freelance, what?
Oh, I don't know.
What I'm trying to get at is your income, you know, haphazard it may be.
No, well, that's the word, actually. I'd use that. Haphazard. I don't know.
Let's have a bit of time, another tack. You haven't got a PAYE code number.
What's that?
Precisely. I will ignore that then. Unemployment benefit. Social Security supplementary benefit. You don't contribute to national insurance, or as we used to call it, stamping your cards.
No.
Mortgage, HP, credit card, pension fund. You've cracked it, haven't you?
Beg pardon?
The system. You haven't got a number. You're not a statistic. You're A spirit, a spectre. They hardly know about you. Where were you when they did the census?
I was out.
I bet you were. Thank you, Helga. They're amazing, aren't they? The best legs in the Department of Inland Revenue. They're not a bad typist either. You know what you are, Mr. McCann? The Invisible Man. Where's your identity? What happens if we have a war? You'll dodge it. We've been after you for 7 years. During that period, you must have had some job.
Well, let me put it like this. I mean, take last week, for example, right? Two nights, I was minding a boozer. They thought it might be a bit of bother, you know. Well, for that, I got 15 quid a night, a couple of sandwiches and a beer. You don't need an accountant for that, do you?
What are you saying? Are you a kind of itinerant bodyguard?
Well, yeah, sort of odd job man, you know.
Daily. Mm-hmm. Daily. Does that mean anything?
Sorry, what was the name?
Yes, Mr. Daly. Apparently, you're his gardener.
His what?
Gardener. As in Percy Thrower. He was unavailable that week.
He hadn't even got a bleeding garden.
Oh, really?
No, but mind you, he has got a very big balcony. Yeah, he likes daffodils and busy lizzies, things like that. He likes horticultural things, you know.
Minding the flowers, eh?
That's it, you got it in one, yeah. How much do I get?
Let's have a look. Ah, yes, the financial year, April 1982, £1,500. That's more or less £30 a week. It's creeping up, isn't it? What with the occasional stint at a boozer and other odds and ends, suddenly you find you're liable to pay tax. Unless you want to say that Mr. Daly is falsifying his claims and books.
Now, look, now, what did you call me earlier? An itinerant bodyguard, right? Well, sometimes I double up as a sort of freelance troubleshooter gardener.
You're long enough, weren't you?
Was I?
This is a very important day today. I put my life on the line.
Clothesline, was it? In the garden?
Eh?
Give us a large whiskey, mate.
You don't drink whiskey.
No, I'll tell you what, make it a treble.
No, we've got no time for that. We're on a tight schedule.
Now, does your garden grow, eh? You owe me 1,500 sovs.
What are you talking about?
Your trusty old retainer. Me, the one with manure on his wellies, the gardener. And you've been a bit too clever this time, Sunshine. You've been sussed. Well, come on, pay the man.
Top.
Cheers, Arthur.
You didn't grass on me, did you?
Of course. Anyway, what do you know about grass, eh? You haven't even got a bleeding garden, have you? You put me right in it. Right in a compost. Funny thing is, of course, you'll get away with it, won't you? But I won't. I'm being assessed now, aren't I? There's forms, letters, appeals.
Tom.
I was on the right result and all then the geezer came up with your annual financial statement. Now, that's got to be the greatest story ever told, isn't it?
Look, you don't understand.
I understand 1,500 sovs.
You're getting a drink out of it.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, make it a watering can full.
Look, it is more important that I should be solvent than you.
Who says?
I do. And I am the brains in this organisation, remember?
Now, I'll tell you what you should remember.
Oh, have a look.
What? Those legs. Should get a Nobel Prize.
Honestly, look, we're talking about important matters and all you can rabbit on about is legs. Is that the only topic that exercises your mind?
Oh, I like Bristol's and all.